What's up, everyone? This is Anthony Pompliano. Most of you know me as Pomp. You're listening to the Pomp Podcast, simply the best podcast out there. Now let's kick this thing off.
This is a special episode of the Pomp Podcast. I unfortunately wasn't able to make it. So we had Darius Dale, the founder and CEO of 42 Macro, sit down and have a conversation with Brian Estes, the off-the-chain capital CEO and CIO, and Perianne Boren, the founder and president of the Chamber of Digital Commerce. In this conversation, they talk about everything from macro data to the crypto markets. I really think that you guys will enjoy this conversation between three people that I have a ton of respect for. I hope that you guys enjoy this one. And before we get started, of course, I first want to talk about our sponsors.
Today's episode is brought to you by Exodus, the world's leading desktop, mobile, and hardware crypto wallet. They offer beautiful, user-friendly blockchain products that sync across all of your devices, making it easier to send, receive, and exchange over 150 or more crypto assets in one place. And with world-class customer service available to you 24/7, Exodus always has your back. But the fun doesn't stop with staking and trading. They recently launched a new NFT marketplace where you can buy and sell your favorite NFTs on the Solana network. By partnering with the popular NFT platform Magic Eden, they're offering the full Monty on verified collections, with more added every single day. Ready to check it out for yourself? Run, don't walk, over to exodus.com/pomp for your free download today. Again, if you want the world's leading desktop, mobile, and hardware crypto wallet, go to exodus.com/pomp today. Today's episode is sponsored by Abra. They're based in California, and they're backed by top VC firms. Abra is an all-in-one, simple, secure app that allows you to trade over 110 cryptocurrencies, get 0% interest loans using your crypto as collateral, and earn interest with up to 13% APY on stablecoins and 7.15% APY on Bitcoin. You can join nearly 2 million users by downloading Abra from the Google Play or Apple App Store. If you download the app today, you will get $15 in free crypto once you fund your account. You came, you invested, now conquer. Abra, conquer crypto. Go check it out today. This episode is brought to you by DeFi Technologies. DeFi Technologies represents what's next in the digital economy. They're providing simplified, trusted access to crypto, decentralized finance, and Web3 investment opportunities. Institutions and investors can gain diversified, secure, compliant, and easily tradable access to a diversified set of industry-leading equity products and protocols through a single stock purchase on a regulated exchange. DeFi Technologies is currently listed on the U.S. exchange at DEFTF stock ticker and the Canadian NEO exchange at DEFI. For more information or to subscribe to receive company updates and financial information, visit their website at defi.tech. I'm really excited about what these guys are doing. I've become an advisor to the business, and I highly suggest you go check them out. Go to their website at defi.tech today.
Anthony Pompliano runs Pomp Investments. All views of him and the guests on his podcast are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Pomp Investments. You should not treat any opinion expressed by Pomp or his guests as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of his personal opinion. This podcast is for informational purposes only.
What's up, guys? You got your host, Darius Dell here. I'm founder and CEO of 42 Macro. We have Perianne Boren of the Chamber of Digital Commerce. I'm also joined with Brian Estes. You guys all knew who Brian Estes is, CIO of Off the Chain Capital, one of the best performing Bitcoin and actual hedge fund in the continental United States. Really proud of you, what you accomplished, Brian. But let's turn it over to you, Perianne. You have obviously a lot going on with this sort of ban, this bill that's going through the New York legislature. Can you talk to us about that? Because that's a very big deal as it relates to
Bitcoin. Yeah, New York is truly mining. Failing us.
New York's still failing us?
Failing us, yes. The legislature is planning to ban proof of work mining in the state. It's technically, they're calling it a two-year moratorium, but it's effectively, it's a ban. This bill has already passed the assembly, and it will come up for consideration in the Senate any day now. Our team at the Chamber of Digital Commerce, we have a team of lobbyists on the ground in Albany. They're working full time on this. And now is the time for anyone who cares about the future of this industry to make your opposition to this bill known. So I'll tell you, our efforts in the House were definitely heard. I'll give you just some play-by-play on what happened because it was it was fascinating.
Take me back. So who's spearheading it? Why are they spearheading it? Like, what's the implications of this bill passing and potentially not passing?
Yeah. So this bill is being pushed by environmentalists, the head sponsor of the bill, Anna Keels. She is she promotes herself on Twitter as a climate activist. It had to pass through committee before it could go to the assembly for a vote. We had worked really, really hard to get as much opposition to this as possible. They brought it up late at night for consideration in that committee, and they basically started the session saying, hey, surprise, we have changed the composition of the committee. There's now a new member on it. And that new member was someone they had recruited who was a supporter of the bill. And that was the only way they were able to get it out of committee.
Oh, geez.
So they were pulling tricks out of their bags. I mean, it was politics at its best and its worst.
Shades of D.C.
But it really showed that people calling and voicing their opposition had a huge impact because they had to go that low just to get it through. And then it passed through the full assembly after that. So
is this bill popular? Like, if it made it to the floor of the assembly, would it actually pass? Or
well, it passed the assembly, so it now has to pass the Senate.
It has to pass the Senate.
And we have a fighting chance. We have a fighting chance based on our whip count. We think we need to flip about 12 Democrats in order for it to fail. Mm-hmm. So we are focusing efforts on Senate Democrats today. For anybody who would like to be a part of us, we're calling on literally everybody around the country, even if you're not located in New York. If you are located in New York, contact your state senator and let them know your opposition to this bill. If you're not in New York, call the Senate leadership and help educate them on why this is bad. We have a campaign. All of the resources we're posting on our Twitter account, it's at Digital Chamber. We have talking points. We have resources so you can find your senator. But now is the fighting chance.
I feel like I represent the sort of collective curiosity, if you will, of the traditional finance community as someone who's very curious about Bitcoin, believes it has a place in your asset allocation, depending on kind of where you are in your investment time horizon, on your investment journey. As that person, as the person who doesn't really understand the full implications, the full scope of maybe the energy, like why does this bill even exist? That's what I don't understand. Like, who is actively out there trying to prevent Bitcoin mining? Give me some stats, give me some facts, give me some figures. What are the issues?
Well, from my position, we should not be passing such a draconian measure into law if we don't understand it.
Mm-hmm.
And clearly, New York does not understand this because there's a lot of misconceptions about why they're pushing this through. They're trying to curb energy use and carbon emissions. Well, Bitcoin uses a negligible amount of energy. It's not going to accomplish any of those goals. Further, there's an alternative piece of legislation that has already passed the assembly that would conduct a task force to put forward a study to understand this better. So, I mean, if logic just prevailed, which, of course, logic and reason don't always prevail in politics.
Logic does not prevail. Money prevails in politics.
We would first understand it and then take action. They're doing it completely backwards.
Fair. Brian, do you think this will have any implications? Like, what's play this forward. Like, let's say the bill passes. You see copycat bills across the nation. Maybe it makes its way to D.C., is there a real implication here as it relates to Bitcoin supply price?
I don't think it's going to pass. I mean, if you look at the truth is that if you take all the world's energy, electricity, Bitcoin consumes 0.1% of the world's electricity. So even if you turn it off, it has, like Perry Andrew said, it has no meaningful effect. And 60% of the electricity that's used to mine Bitcoin comes from green or renewable energy sources. So in the United States, 20% of our energy use, electrical use, is from green energy or renewable. Mm-hmm. So the Bitcoin mining industry is three times more greener than the average U.S. consumer.
Wow.
So it's
this is just an attack on Bitcoin.
It's fake information out there, getting people riled up. And it's, like I said, even if you turn it off, it doesn't make a difference.
Gotcha. So this is the kind of, I thank you for sharing that because I've not heard those stats. All I've heard and seen is really Greta Thunberg saying that Bitcoin's going to, sink the planet. right? Like, from what I just heard from you, if we turned off all Bitcoin mining globally, the planet will be underwater in 51 instead of 2050, right?
Here's the other part of that. So building off what Brian's talking about in terms of Bitcoin mining being a huge user and consumer of renewables, the Bitcoin mining industry is one of the largest investors in sustainable energy operations. Oh, yeah. And we believe Bitcoin mining has the opportunity to lead the transition to green and sustainable power operations around the country and potentially around the world. So by just saying anything proof of work is going to be banned in this state, all of those mines are just going to go elsewhere. There's plenty of more friendly states like Texas that are opening them with welcome arms, who are partnered with renewable plants and helping fund the build out of more renewable sources around the country. So it will have the complete opposite effect.
It's so interesting, like, and this maybe is a little bit off topic, but there's a real bifurcation in regulatory policy. Like, we've always had the bifurcation in regulatory policy across the United States of America. But in this particular time right now, this moment that we're in, it seems like it's getting wider.
It's so partisan.
States like Florida and Texas are really driving innovation forward. Mm-hmm. We have states like Illinois, New York, California really kind of clinging on to how the world used to be. And I think that's going to cause a lot of problems. It's going to cause a lot of migration. It's going to create a lot of opportunities. Like, any sort of opportunities you guys seeing as a function of this?
I mean, we're in Florida now, and you talk to any real estate agent around here, mm-hmm. you know, where are people moving from? They're moving from Illinois and New York,
totally,
down to Florida. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, the rules that that they put in a place, that it just drives people out of their communities.
Totally.
And this is an example of that.
And these are the best and brightest
jobs.
Too, by the way.
These are new jobs that could be in New York, and they're going to drive them down to Texas.
Totally. Totally, 100%. And yeah, it's not like this, you're not getting rid of the worst people. You're getting rid of the best and brightest and arguably some of the most productive people mm-hmm. who are creating jobs and innovating. And obviously, you know, there's that old age old, capital versus labor discussion. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't need to get into that. I don't think we have enough time today to unpack that onion. But certainly, I do believe there's a lot going on. Can we talk about something, shifting gears a little bit, educating me, the TradFi guy? What's the difference between proof of stake and proof of work? I get it conceptually, but is there something deeper to understand, or is it just as obvious as it sounds?
Typically, the way that I try to explain this to policymakers is that proof of stake is not an alternative to proof of work, because that's one of the arguments. They're like, oh, well, even if we ban proof of work, there's other things like proof of stake, and that'll be fine. Mm-hmm. But they're mistakenly believing that the operations of proof of stake and what that provides is an alternative to proof of work. Mm-hmm. So proof of work creates digital property. Proof of stake does not. These are largely smart contracts applications. These are places to build decentralized applications. Gotcha. That is a completely different application. That is a completely different use case than a store of value or a digital gold. They're just not the same.
Gotcha.
So I'll give an example. So when you go out and mine gold, you go buy land, or lease land, you buy equipment, you spend time, cultivating that land to find like gold nuggets, right?
Of course.
So the gold nugget is your proof of work. Mm-hmm. You had an outlay of capital, you had an outlay of time, and the result was a gold nugget. That's your proof of work. Mm-hmm. Like a proof of stake is like Microsoft operating system or iOS on your iPhone. It's an operating system. There's no, there's no tangible item at the end of your, So proof of stake is they're contracts on the internet using blockchain technology to allow decentralized finance, to allow prediction markets, to allow exchanges to occur. Mm-hmm. Whereas, like Perry Ann said, proof of stake is, there's property, there's digital property, which is like a Bitcoin or
proof of work.
It's
the creation of digital property.
Yeah.
A digital bearer instrument, which is what Bitcoin is.
Gotcha. And so Bitcoin seems like it stands apart from a lot of the other sort of tokens, crypto tokens.
Absolutely.
Are there any other proof of work?
Yeah. So the proof of work blockchains that are out there, there's Bitcoin. There's all the hard forks off Bitcoin.
Yep.
Like Bitcoin Cash, Bitcoin SV. Yep. There's Dogecoin, Monero, Zcash. If you add all those up, all those proof of work blockchains up, Bitcoin constitutes 92% of the value of all the proof of work blockchains. So the world has already decided that Bitcoin's the winner for proof of work.
Of course.
You know, people talk about Dogecoin and Bitcoin Cash, and you know, they don't have the network that Bitcoin has. And so they're going to fail. They're in the process of failing.
Of course.
Bitcoin will eventually, you'll have one proof of work blockchain, and that's going to be Bitcoin.
There's only one.
And the world's already decided that. And, you know, the Bitcoin wars occurred about 4 years ago with all the hard forks off of Bitcoin. Like Bitcoin Cash is actually better technology than Bitcoin, the original Bitcoin is, but people don't use it. So it doesn't have the network effect that Bitcoin does. And so, you know, so eventually all those other proof of work blockchains become worthless, and Bitcoin is 99.9% of the proof of work blockchains that are out there.
You said this war sort of took place around 4 years ago.
Yeah, the Bitcoin wars.
Yeah. So what was the catalyst? What sort of happened there? The cypherpunks, I guess.
So we had Bitcoin, the original code, and then there were developers and miners and, you know, exchanges that wanted to upgrade the system, because the problem with Bitcoin is that it's slow, and each block can only have 1 megabyte of information on it. And so when those blocks get full, when you try to do a lot of transactions, then the blocks get full and it backs up. Instead of a block clearing every 10 minutes, it could take 2 or 3 hours to print a new block to the blockchain. And so what they wanted to do was increase the block size, and that will allow more transactions to go through. And if you do that, then what happens is that there are fewer and fewer people that could actually mine or clear the transactions on the Bitcoin network. So it concentrates the power with fewer people if you start increasing the block size. And so there was a big argument. Do we increase the block size? Do we not? And half the people wanted to, half the people didn't. And so what someone finally did was said, we're going to create a new Bitcoin called Bitcoin Cash, and we'll increase the block size. And then they did that, and just people don't use it.
You said something just now that really caught my attention, and you said it twice, actually. The people. Who is the people?
It's consensus. It's the community.
Community.
So it's a combination of users, you know, Bitcoin owners, right? The exchanges that custody Bitcoin, the developers that, you know, that in, you know, change the code to make it better. It's the people that make the hardware that mine Bitcoin or clear the transactions. So everyone has to come together to a consensus to decide, is this the best change for Bitcoin? And if you, you know, if you don't want to change it, you could stick with your original code, or you could create a hard fork, which is all the history of the original blockchain, and you have a new one called Bitcoin Cash or Bitcoin SV, which has the new technology in it. And then you just wait and see if people want to start using that.
Oh, gotcha.
And so there's all sorts of versions of Bitcoin out there.
Yeah.
You know, there's, like I said, Bitcoin Cash, Bitcoin Cash SV, Bitcoin Diamond, Bitcoin Gold. You know,
what's the one we all quote and cite?
That's just Bitcoin. That's just the original Bitcoin code.
Gotcha. That makes sense.
The core.
But going back to kind of your original question, so you have proof of work blockchains, and Brian just outlined why Bitcoin is the winner. Mm-hmm. It has dominated in terms of market cap of all the other proof of work blockchains. And proof of stake, we're still in too early of days to know who the winner is going to be.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of competition. It's hyper competitive right now against different proof of stake networks. And
strikes me that it's odd that there would be a winner for that. It seems like that's so much more specialized. Like certain proof of stake tokens
could be
used for, you know, XYZ transactions.
Yeah, there may be a couple, but there's not going to be thousands.
Yeah, it's true.
There'll be a handful.
Yeah. So there's obviously been a ton of capital pouring into the space in the last couple of years. I mean, there's been a ton of capital sloshed around global financial markets the last couple of years to begin with. So obviously crypto is being the innovative kind of opportunity set that it provides, we've seen a lot of capital. Where are we in that, in the broader capital markets cycle for the crypto space, or at least in your estimation?
Yeah, so I've been involved since 2014.
Yeah,
you know, back then Bitcoin had a market cap of around $3 billion. Uh-huh. Today it's, you know, $850 billion. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it hit a trillion a few months ago, but you still don't see a lot of big institutional investors allocating to the space yet. So it's mainly, you know, libertarian in nature, family offices. You know, we did see an insurance company come in about a year and a half ago, MassMutual.
They bought
$100 million worth of Bitcoin. You have a couple of public corporations who own Bitcoin now on their balance sheet, MicroStrategy and Tesla. But the big institutional money, the brokers, I think you come from traditional finance, like Goldman Sachs, Wells Fargo Advisors, Edward Jones, they're still not ready to allow their clients to invest in that space yet.
It's interesting. I saw that Fidelity, I know the guys that are over there pretty well, they had some rule change that allows investors to start allocating to Bitcoin in their 401ks. Mm-hmm. That's a pretty significant step. I mean, they're sitting on a couple $1 trillion of people's money.
Fidelity Retirement's about $3 trillion, but they also have $8 trillion of brokerage assets too.
Oh, geez.
So you would think eventually, if they allow it in their retirement plans, they'll allow it in their brokerage accounts too. Abby Johnson runs Fidelity. She got involved with Bitcoin about 7 years ago, mm-hmm. and Fidelity started mining Bitcoin, internally. And then they were figuring out, what's the use case for this? And they came up with the use cases as an investment tool, mm-hmm. Which is the same thing the Federal Reserve said 4 years ago. Wow. Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis came out with a white paper in 2018. And in their white paper, they said basically Bitcoin's best use case is as an investment tool and diversification tool for portfolios. And the reason they said that is because it's a non-correlated asset. Mm-hmm. And when you add a small amount of non-correlated assets to an investment portfolio, it increases what's called the Sharpe ratio.
Oh, yeah.
So your risk-adjusted returns go up when you add Bitcoin to a portfolio. And so if you're a fiduciary, you're an asset manager, your whole job is to increase your risk-adjusted returns. Mm-hmm. And so as more professional asset managers understand this, then they add Bitcoin to their portfolio.
So I'll take it a step further. And you know the inner workings of finance as well as I do. I don't think the main job of investment managers is to increase the risk-adjusted return. The main job is to have money to manage. Right. You get the
main
joke.
Main job is not to get sued.
Exactly. It's to maintain your assets under management and hopefully grow them over time. that tends to be the case. So clearly there's this sort of, it strikes me that the demand for Bitcoin and I wouldn't necessarily say crypto, I'd say Bitcoin specifically because it is a store of value type asset, far sort of exceeds the regulatory ability for investors to get their hands on it. I mean, I can't tell you if I've had one investment manager say, "Oh, if only I could do this," or an investor say, "Oh, if only they had an ETF instead of a trust," or like Grayscale, things of that nature, "I could do this, I can do that." Where are we in that sort of continuum of development and kind of regulatory change? Like, when will we see Bitcoin ETF, Bitcoin widely offered in 401ks, et cetera?
I think Perry Ann's best to answer that.
Yeah. Well, specifically on a Bitcoin ETF or a spot Bitcoin. Of course, we have futures Bitcoin ETFs.
Yeah.
So since 2013, companies have been trying to get a spot Bitcoin ETF through the SEC process. Mm-hmm. So the Winklevoss twins were the first one to do that in 2013. We at the chamber, we represent close to a dozen companies who have tried to get a spot Bitcoin ETF through the SEC process. We're currently interviewing each one of those companies to really understand what that process was like. And we're learning a lot of very interesting information about how the SEC has handled this. We will be issuing a report on this shortly, and we will be delivering that report to Congress, who oversees and provides oversight of the SEC. And just without kind of spoiling too much, based on our early findings of these interviews, we believe the SEC is not following their own mandates and is acting arbitrary and capricious.
You hear that, Gary?
And I think there absolutely could be some very strong pieces there for litigation if someone wanted to move forward with that. But we don't have even rules to the road. Accredited investors and non-accredited investors today have access to very different crypto products. And they're holding this industry inconsistent to other commodity markets.
Yeah, I was going to say, it strikes me that the treatment of you know, Bitcoin is and cryptocurrency and digital assets in itself, it's very different than how we treat equities, commodities, fixed income,
and all these other products. And that's not the SEC's job. That is not the SEC's job. So
whose job is it?
Well, it's not their job to pick winners and losers, and that's what they're doing, because they're saying it's okay for all these asset classes to move forward, but for Bitcoin, for crypto, we're going to hold it to a completely different standard. And even the commissioners at the SEC do not agree on the process. So some have been a part of holding up getting any spot crypto Bitcoin ETFs through the process, but then you have SEC Commissioner Hester Peirce, whose nickname is Crypto Mom on Twitter, who has dissented against a number of these actions. And she has written at length about that she does not agree with the process. We're holding this industry to a different standard, and we are not operating in accordance with our mandates.
Mm-hmm. And is the reason for that, are they protecting the barbarians at the gate, so to speak?
Well, that's certainly one, you know, one reason people
like me employed effectively. No, because there's a real threat, right? Like, it's the decentralized finance is a major threat to how we're currently operating from a financial services perspective.
Yeah, I mean, we definitely have a lot of pretty significant questions about what the motives are, because at this point, they are not following their mandates, and they're not holding this industry to the same standards of other commodity markets. So it's time for Congress to step in and provide oversight on that.
I mean, finance and money will become decentralized.
Yeah, of course.
So there's no question. It's just a matter of when.
Yeah.
And so what the government's doing is trying to slow it down, slow down the pace. Yep. So, you know, it's going to be very disruptive over the next 10 to 20 years as this happens. But all new technologies are disruptive.
Totally.
Yeah, it's just...
How disruptive was the internet to travel agents?
Right, exactly.
You know, or any other thing that used to go somewhere to do.
Right?
But with the internet, it was a lot different, right? So the beginning architecture of the internet, that was created by the U.S. government through a program at DARPA with Vint Cerf and Bob Kahn. They created all of that original code. And they built that for a defense project. And then they saw that there could be a lot of commercial value to this. And so at the time, the Clinton and Gore administration, they passed a series of executive orders stating that this is going to be a revolutionary technology, and we want to incentivize United States businesses to commercialize this. Mm-hmm. And it set a whole process in place to do that. And we did exactly that. And that led to one of the greatest economic booms this nation has ever seen.
The greatest.
And we still dominate. The United States still dominates the internet today. And that has created so many benefits for the United States. Blockchain technology is just as important technology as the internet.
Wow, that's a bold statement. I want
Andreessen
you to unpack
also
that.
Also said that too. Yeah, I mean, there's a quote by Mark Andreessen that sometimes we quote where he said this is just as important as the internet itself.
Wow.
And if so Bob Kahn, who was one of the co-inventors of the internet, he lives right outside of DC, and I've had him come in several times to talk to our members, just like, what was that like? Mm-hmm. And how do you compare that to what you see with blockchain technology? And he has stated several times to us that the initial architecture of the internet was broken because they did not have a way to send things of value in a peer-to-peer way. Mm-hmm. Like, it was supposed to be a peer-to-peer communications network, and that's what it is. But that does not work when you implement anything of money or anything of value.
Gotcha.
Digital objects is the term that he uses. We say digital assets.
And there's been a lot of people over the last 30 years of trying to figure out how do we send value through the internet peer-to-peer.
Mm-hmm.
So Elon Musk and Peter Thiel, they started a company called PayPal back in 1998.
Mm-hmm.
So their original goal back in 1998 was to create Bitcoin. They wanted to create the software that allowed this peer-to-peer transfer of value through the internet. And they couldn't figure out how to do it. But, you know, it's been a problem for a long time. And then, you know, a person named Satoshi Nakamoto, or a group of people called Satoshi Nakamoto, finally figured out how to create this software. And they just gave it to the world for free.
What was the eureka moment?
It's the double spend problem, ultimately, is that problem that the issue that had to be fixed. Which is, how do you send something of value in a digital way without going through an intermediary?
Gotcha.
And without being able to copy and paste it and send it to someone else.
Yeah,
so if I send you a dollar, I shouldn't be able to copy and paste that same dollar and send it to Perry Ann.
Or think of it if you take a photo on your cell phone and you text it to me. Mm-hmm. So what really happens is I have a copy of that photo on my phone and you have a copy of that photo on your phone. Great.
Mm-hmm.
Awesome. that does not work if money. So if you want to send me a dollar, it's really important that when you send it, it leaves your device and it's only on my device. They didn't figure out how to do that until Bitcoin.
Gotcha. And do we, I mean, this is, pardon my dumb questions. I'm hoping the listeners get a lot out of this. Have they sort of, I mean, obviously they figured that out, but do we know what that is? Like what was the solution? What was the technological solution?
The solution is it's properly decentralized.
Yeah. And it's proof of work.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Go ahead.
It's the way that Bitcoin works. I mean, that allows for that to happen. So and when the internet was commercialized because of this issue, they had to retrofit the financial services industry on top.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So now, and the internet revolutionized all sorts of industries, media being one of the first and one of the most important. Mm-hmm. But financial services, the rails of financial services never really changed.
Oh, no. We're still doing T+2.
And so now we are just starting to see that evolution and that revolution and that software upgrade for financial services. And that's why this is such an impactful technology, because the internet evolution didn't stop. It's now taking a whole another form with the introduction of blockchains.
Gotcha.
So if you go back to like the early 90s, like Perian mentioned, back in 1992, it was against the law to do a commercial transaction or advertise on the internet. It was actually against the law to do that. And so Al Gore and, the Clinton administration, passed laws to commercialize the internet that allowed us to do commercial transactions and advertise. But the problem back then is we couldn't figure out that software to transfer value through the internet. Mm-hmm. And so we built the internet on top of the current banking system.
Yeah.
So in the credit card system that we have today. Mm-hmm. But it was built wrong. We all know it was built wrong 30 years ago, mm-hmm. but that was the only solution. So what we're doing today, now that we have a solution, like the software that allows us to transfer value through the internet today, now, once we have that software, we're rebuilding the entire internet and we're putting it on blockchain technology. Mm. So that's what's going to happen over the next 10 to 20 years. The entire internet is being rebuilt on blockchain technology.
So give me a, that is a big statement, and I definitely agree with you. I don't know why I agree with you, but I can feel it.
So it's magical power.
Yeah.
No. So when you do that, you're taking power away from the banking system, right? The banks, the credit card companies.
Well, I think
because they're not efficient as blockchain.
It might actually even be bigger than banks. I mean, think about the power that a Google has over the internet, or Facebook, mm-hmm. or, I mean, they own every social media platform, or Twitter. What do those... let's leave banking aside, because I think it's pretty clear that finance is going to be disintermediated and it's just going to have to change to deal with this new world. How will the everyday human being interact with this new blockchain-enabled internet?
Well, a lot of people do it today. You have Venmo. Do you use Venmo?
Yeah.
Venmo is a blockchain-based application owned by PayPal.
Oh.
They bought it 5 years ago.
Yeah.
So PayPal offers Bitcoin today.
So in the state of New York, the application that was built for your vaccine passports, the ID, I don't know the name of it, but the ID system on your phone. Yeah. This is me holding up a phone. That's a blockchain application that was built by
IBM. Millennial on earth without a phone.
I just came out of the womb with one in my hand. That was a blockchain application built by IBM.
Yeah, gotcha. You really don't want to know you're using blockchain.
Or you don't need to.
You don't need to.
The user doesn't need to know.
Yeah, so it's just the technology powering. For example, when you make a phone call today, mm-hmm. most phone calls are through voice over internet protocol. They're not going through like a cable line somewhere. Mm-hmm. But you don't know if you're using VoIP or cable or copper or what. You just know your phone call goes through, right? Mm-hmm. So that's what blockchain will enable in the future. You'll be using it. You just won't know you're using blockchain technology. Just like when you use Venmo today, you don't know you're using blockchain.
Gotcha. And so how does Venmo, sorry about these dumb questions. I love learning about stuff. How does Venmo work? Like, is Venmo proof of work as well? Like, how does that work? Is there some sort of intermediary?
So when PayPal bought Venmo, it's centralized now.
Yeah.
So Venmo is a centralized application. So it's not, Bitcoin is a public blockchain. So anyone could use it. It's not discriminatory. Like, it's, anyone in the world could just use Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. With Venmo, you need permission. to use it. You have to apply. You have to put your personal information in and get a Venmo account. But so it's a private blockchain.
Is it truly blockchain, though? Because it's still linking to my checking account.
It's using the blockchain technology.
Gotcha.
To transfer value.
Gotcha. And so you just said something that I think is important to hear as well if you're in a TradFi space. It can very much enable traditional finance. It doesn't have to disintermediate or put more.
No, it's to make it better. It's to make it 100 times better.
It makes it better.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, Jim Bianco, this guy, really good investor, he talks about sort of how, and Jim Bianco and Eric Townsend over at Macro Voices, they talk about how the entire bond market, the whole concept of the bond market doesn't make any sense in the blockchain era. This concept that I'm going to give you money, I hope that you pay it back, give me a little interest, and 5 years from now or 10 years from now, 30 years from now, you get my money back. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't make any sense. There's a better way to transfer value, to store, to capitalize economies and businesses.
Okay.
It strikes me that we're on to something here.
Yeah, that goes back 700 years. So back in the 1400s, we started using ledger technology.
Yeah.
So you have, debits and credits, right? Yep. You have a ledger.
Oh, yeah.
And if you move money from one side of the ledger to the other side, that transfers the value.
Totally.
That's all Bitcoin is. It's ledger technology, except that this ledger, we're taking it and we're distributing it around the world every 10 minutes and updating it. So everybody's using the same ledger. And so now you don't have to have the reconciliation between two banks. Like if I move money, if you have a JP Morgan account, and I have a Bank of America account, and I move money to you, JP Morgan and Bank of America have to reconcile their two ledgers to move that money. But if I send you Bitcoin or value through a Bitcoin or a blockchain network, that network, it's just one network. There's no reconciliation required. It just moves it from one side of the ledger to the other side of the ledger. And that's what transfers the value. So you don't have to wait a day for that process to batch. It just batches whenever it updates, like in 10 minutes for Bitcoin, or every millisecond for Solana or Cardano or some of the other blockchains that are out there.
Wow, that's really powerful. And so talk to me about why are there more sort of fails then? I mean, because obviously there's all kinds of shenanigans going on from a counterparty risk perspective and traditional finance. I mean, that's kind of the trigger for the financial crisis was everyone realizing that Lehman was not good money and they're a counterparty for all these big derivative contracts. Mm-hmm. Why is that not a risk with blockchain technology? Like, it strikes me that would be a core bug, if you will, of the system, is it not?
So there are risks with like owning Bitcoin, like your wallet could get hacked or where you keep your Bitcoin, that custodian could get hacked.
Mm-hmm.
But the Bitcoin network itself, the Bitcoin blockchain has never been hacked. Mm-hmm. It uses cryptography. It uses military-grade SHA-256 cryptography that has never been hacked. Wow. So it's unhackable. Gotcha. There's almost $1 trillion of value in the Bitcoin blockchain. If someone could hack it, they're going to take the $1 trillion.
Yeah,
there's $1 trillion bounty to go hack it.
Totally.
Yeah, so go hack it.
I'm sure Putin's been trying.
Yeah, people have been trying to hack it. You can't hack it. You can't break the SHA-256 cryptography.
Gotcha.
And then people say, the next question is, well, what about quantum computers? And so quantum computers, if they ever got close enough to be able to break that cryptography, that SHA-256, the developers would just turn up the next step to SHA-512 and then to SHA-1028. And then SHA-2040, they just keep turning up their cryptography. What eventually happens is that there's not enough electricity in the world to break that code.
Yeah.
And if you turn it up high enough, there's not enough electrons in the universe to break it.
Wow.
So it's unhackable.
Wow.
The power behind it, the computational power behind the network, protects the money, protects that value.
Gotcha. Folks, if you guys are listening to this, this is a masterclass. I really appreciate this. So let's switch gears a little bit, shift gears. Where are we in the crypto investing cycle? I have my own thoughts about where we are in the broader macroeconomic and liquidity cycles, but I'd love to hear kind of from two people who are native to the crypto space or very, deeply intertwined in it. Where do you think we are in the investing cycle?
All right. So if you look at U.S. households, 25% of U.S. households own Bitcoin today. So we're on our way. So if you use what's called S-curve analysis, so S-curve analysis is how you measure the adoption rate of new technologies. So Bitcoin was started in 2009. By 2019, 10% of households in the U.S. owned Bitcoin. In 2020, the comptroller of the U.S. currency, Brian Brooks, said it was 15%. The Biden administration, just about a month ago in their executive order, said it was 25%. And so we're on this pathway to 90% adoption by 2029. Wow. So the time you want to own this is during that mass adoption.
Yeah.
So between 2019 to 2029 is when you want to buy Bitcoin. After 2029, the growth is on a level out.
Yeah.
So it's still early. And that's just in the U.S. If you look worldwide, it's less than 1% of people in the world own Bitcoin. So it's still very early. And the reason people don't own it is they just don't understand it. You know, they think, you know, it's like me. When I first learned about Bitcoin in 2014, I thought it was a total scam. I thought it was like, I saw Cameron and Tyler Winklevoss on CNBC talking about Bitcoin when it was $100.
Can't trust Harvard guys.
And, exactly. And I just thought they were doing a pump and dump. I couldn't believe it. And it took me about 6 months to figure out what this really was. And it's all it is ledger technology. We've been using the same ledger technology for 700 years. And this is the advancement, of ledger technology. And once you understand that, then you have to own it. And, you know, it just makes sense to put 1 to 5% of your net worth in this. As I look at it as protection. As we transition from the current monetary system that we have today into the next monetary system, which is going to be based on blockchain technology, you need to protect your assets. And the way you do that is you just put some of it in Bitcoin and hold it for the next 10, 20, 30 years.
Gotcha. I like that. What are your thoughts?
Well, I'm a monetary thinker like you. And if we look at how much money has changed just in the past 100 years, we have to expect that money is going to evolve just as much or even more rapidly.
Probably more,
because now we have more advanced technologies available. So the I guess in the past 7,500 years, the evolution of money, we began with the gold standard. So at the Bretton Woods conference, the agreement set a gold standard for the whole world. And the world came together and they decided that gold was going to be fixed at $35 an ounce. The US dollar would be the reserve currency, and then all other countries would peg their currency to the dollar, but they could legally demand gold from the treasury. That's what money was. Not that long ago, just a couple of decades ago. That system broke down very quickly. They were not able to maintain the peg, and by the 1980s, we fully transitioned to fiat. And 80% of industrialized nations were using floating currencies, which is what fiat currencies are today. So that's a huge change.
Massive change.
Especially considering that gold and things of scarcity is what civilizations have used for exchange, for money, for thousands of years. So that was a massive evolution in what money is. And since the 80s, you know, we're now seeing additional evolutions in what is money. And with the introduction of the internet and artificial intelligence and blockchains and cryptocurrencies, we're going to see money change just as much. So I think we're going to see a huge change in the next 10, 20 years. And I agree with Brian. I think blockchains are going to be the foundation of our financial system.
Yeah, no, it's you said the word change at least 7 or 8 times. And to me, when I hear the word change, I hear see opportunities. Obviously, there's winners and losers. But you also hear, you think about the losers. The change is inherently scary for the legacy players, right? The central banks, we talk to Pomp and I, the boys, we riff on this whole concept of a central bank digital currency, a centralized blockchain-enabled digital currency. It strikes me that the folks with the guns down in D.C., where you've lived, don't want to transition from, having the exorbitant privilege that comes with, being the world's reserve currency.
Absolutely.
How do we go from state A, which is where we are today, to State B? Because I think we all agree that State B is coming. Is that process deadly, bloody, terrifying, financial markets? Like, how do, you know, how do we go from A to B without causing a lot of uproar?
It's a volunteer network. Mm-hmm. So no one forces you to own Bitcoin. Yeah. You volunteer into the system. Mm-hmm. So once you understand it, you know, you buy a little bit of Bitcoin. You join the parallel financial system. And so it's not going to be bloody. It's not going to be violent.
It's
going to be a peaceful protest.
I'll give you two real world examples.
Yeah, please do.
So Venezuela has seen huge amounts of economic challenges just within the past couple of years.
Gone into a black hole.
And it wasn't always like that. I mean, Venezuela used to be an absolutely beautiful and safe place to live. But more recently, they've hyperinflated their currency, and that's caused economic ruin. There was, it was the last time we hosted our DC Blockchain Summit, that's our conference we host at the Chamber. There was an article on the front page of the Washington Post or the New York Times or some mainstream publication, and it was a story about a family who had to get out of the country very fast, and the only way they could do that was using Bitcoin to buy a plane ticket and everything they needed to get out, and it's how they got all their wealth out of the country.
Wow.
So that was one example. Another example more recently is in Afghanistan. So Off the Chain made a donation to the Human Rights Foundation to help Afghan women basically escape the country when Taliban took over. But there's a school there who has been teaching women how to code and been paying them in Bitcoin since about 2013. And when these women had to escape, a lot of times you can't take anything with you, but they managed to be able to take their private keys. And when they got to their new location, they were able to start their life over.
That's awesome.
Using those resources that they had saved. So I see Bitcoin as an alternative. You never know when your financial system or your banking system is just not going to work. I mean, I don't think people in Venezuela or Afghanistan could have ever imagined what happened. But when it does happen, it's really important that you have tools to protect your wealth. And Bitcoin is that option. It can be an option. And one of my passions is helping educate as many people as possible about what this technology is, what it can be used for, and how to safely navigate it in the extent you need it.
Gotcha. It's basically just property that you could self-custody. Mm-hmm. So it's like having a bar of gold in your house or cash.
Who doesn't?
Yeah. You know, so it's just property. And if you want to escape the country you're in, or you want to, you know, have assets that you self-custody that can't be seized, you know, you could hold the Bitcoin private key in your head. You can memorize the private key. So I can have my money in my head.
Yeah.
You know, how's someone going to take that from me?
Can't.
Right? So, yeah, and, you know, you look at what happened in Canada a couple months ago with the truckers. You know, they started shutting down bank accounts of people who donated $10 to the truckers.
We're going
to
write books about that, by the way. Yeah. I think that's one of the most underreported stories of my
entire career. It's underreported on purpose, too, because that encourages people to buy Bitcoin, right? Yeah. The government doesn't want to report that.
Totally.
Yeah, they realized pretty quickly that they were making a mistake.
Oh, yeah.
And so they stopped that program real fast. But, you know, if you donated money to the truckers, paid $10 and your bank account got shut down, how are you supposed to pay your heating bill, pay your healthcare costs, buy food?
Totally.
You know, the government just shut down your bank account. Oh, yeah. So you need some self-sovereign money in your house to survive. And so, you know, if you're a sovereign individual, you need to have some Bitcoin. You need to have something that you could spend in case the government takes you
something
off the financial
system.
Money
that you actually
own. Mm-hmm. Money, that's great. Yeah.
Money that you actually own. Yeah.
So let's get a little draconian here. So I have a firm belief that we're moving to a multipolar world. I think that's pretty clear. Eventually it'll be a unipolar world again as China overtakes us. You know, this is the history of empires and nations. You rise, you fall, and get replaced by the new guy. And very clearly, it looks like China's going to be the new guy, obviously not tomorrow. What sort of, you know, I wonder about kind of, you know, an asset that is borderless, if you will, you know, that creates, that allows, you know, people, humans, investors, businesses, companies to sort of transform and store wealth sort of outside of, quote unquote, whatever the system is. Right now, it's sort of technically speaking outside of the dollar system. As we transition to this sort of multipolar world where there's bound to be a lot of friction, potentially conflict, obviously there's conflict in Russia, Ukraine, and that could obviously potentially get worse if we get NATO involved. It strikes me that Bitcoin will become more valuable to the human, but even increasingly less valuable to the state, in the sense that they're going to want capital controls, all these types of things that tend to force people into Bitcoin. They're actually going to put up more walls to prevent that from happening. Do you see any sort of clear, present obstacles, challenges for further adoption? Because it sounds like we're all on this rosy S-curve and everything's great, but I also understand that we're currently in a fourth turning. I don't know if you guys are familiar with the concept of fourth turning, but my former colleague, Noah Howell, wrote a book back in the 90s, effectively talks about how human beings go in this sort of multi-generational cycle. There's generational archetypes, and when they align in a certain pattern, you tend to create conflict, dissension, destruction of institutions. And I firmly believe that sort of there's a few institutions that I think we're going to destroy in this current fourth turning that we're still in. I think the two-party system's probably on its way out in the United States of America. It doesn't seem like it's working for anyone, not even the two parties at this point. I do believe that, look, the sort of concept of dollar hegemony and this sort of U.S. being this dominant force in the world is probably on its way out, if only because we have enough problems internally that we have to turn and face inward to solve some of our own internal challenges. It strikes me that Bitcoin is a way out of that for the person, for the human, but it's a challenge and an obstacle for the state.
Who does the state serve?
People, in theory, or the state. Does the state serve us, or does the state serve the state?
You know? Well, it's supposed to serve its people, right? Yeah. So the government should be doing what's best for its citizenry. Mm-hmm. And I believe that a sound monetary system is what's best. Mm-hmm. A currency that can be stolen by an unelected, group of bureaucrats at a non-government agency, non-federal agency, that's not what's best for the people.
By the way, just no offense, obviously, as my fiance is a white woman. We have like 10 old white dudes sit around a room and determine what the quantity and price of money is for the whole world. Isn't that a ridiculous concept in 2022?
And that has only been going, and remember, that did not exist even just a couple
until
of
1933,
decades.
Right? Yeah.
Well, 1913 was 13, when the Fed was established. Yeah. But the way that our current monetary system works is very, very, very new.
Yeah.
And so, and it's also, in my opinion, it's unconstitutional.
What a ridiculous activity.
Yeah, using gold and silver for debts and for paying debts. So I believe what's best is having sound money. And maybe that is, I think it's Bitcoin, but maybe it could be something else. I don't know what else it would be. I don't really see another kind of competitor to that today. But, the idea of having this world reserve currency where you have this unique authority of implementing sanctions, like that is something very, very new.
So, Darius, you said something really important while you said you have a bunch of people sitting around an oval table, deciding what the price of money is.
And the supply.
So they determine what the interest rate is and, like you just said, the supply of money. Yeah. So over the last 2 years, the U.S. government has printed 40% more dollars than were in existence 2 years ago. And then people today wonder, why are my prices going up?
Of course.
Why are car prices up? Why is gas up? Why is my home price up?
Totally.
Why is my rent up? Why is my healthcare cost up?
Totally.
And the reason is that there's more dollars in circulation than there were before. So the dollars that you owned before are worth less than they were.
Totally.
Because there's more dollars out there. So when you have more of something, it's worth less. And so your home that you live in, it's probably the same 3 bedrooms, 2 baths, same lot, right? Your home didn't grow 30%. Mm-hmm. Your home doesn't provide you 30% more utility than it did, 2 years ago, but it's worth 30% more. Well, it's not really worth 30% more. What's happened is that the dollar has lost 30% of its value.
Totally.
So it takes more dollars to buy the same home and to buy the same gallon of gas or the bushel of wheat or the car, right? And so what that's called theft. The government is stealing from us. When they print, so we go out and we, spend 40 hours a week or 60 hours a week working, right? We put time in, we put labor in, we get a paycheck. And if the government could just hit Control P and print more dollars, they just stole part of my paycheck.
Stole part of your life.
Right.
Which is, what money is the transfer of human time, which is your life.
And that's slavery. slavery.
So it's immoral. So these people sitting around the table deciding how much money to print, they're basically deciding how much slavery should I impose on people.
Absolutely.
And they're stealing your time and your money. And so that's not right. It's immoral for that to happen. And so Bitcoin fixes that problem. You can't create more than 21 million Bitcoin. Finite supply capped at 21 million, never be over 21 million. No one's ever print 22 million Bitcoin. So there's a cap, there's a finite supply, and that theft will stop once we're on a Bitcoin standard.
God damn it, I'm so bearish, but I don't want to run out and buy more Bitcoin. And so I'll give my two spiel on the kind of
same
market
outlook.
But you were talking earlier, like, what's the transition?
Yeah.
You know, it's like having a baby. It's not comfortable, and it's a lot of risk with that. But once you have the baby, and then, you know, you have all this, you know, hope for the future.
Yeah.
Right? And that's, you know, that's coming. Yeah. You know, it's going to be a hard transition. But once we get on the other side of this in 10 or 20 years, the future is like bright for all humanity. You know, the next 1,000 years are going to be great. Yeah. We just have to get off this government issued money system that we've been on for 51 years. 1971, we were on commodity based money because our money was backed by gold.
Yep.
After 1971, it's based on how much money do we want to print, right? Yeah. And so that system is failing us. We see it failing us right in front of our eyes. And all we have to do is, you know, decide as humankind to get off the system and get on to the new system, and then the transition will be complete. And it just doesn't happen overnight. People have to be educated. I mean, Perry Ann and I, we drove down to Miami this morning, 3.5 hours, to come talk to you because we want to help educate people on what's going on. You know, it's important.
Educated.
And,
look, this has been an awesome discussion. I walked in here. I thought I knew a lot about, digital asset space, crypto. I try to, weave it into traditional finance and in the context of portfolio construction. And I think it's so much bigger than that. You know, I think there's a real movement here, and I can understand why everyone I talk to in this space is so passionate about it, because it is revolutionary. It's game changing. Now, that doesn't mean you need to buy it at every price. That doesn't mean that every price that ticks and clears on the screen, on the squiggly line on the screen, is a good price to purchase it at. That doesn't necessarily mean you should not have some allocation to this revolution. So, Brian, Perry Ann, any parting thoughts?
Ladies first.
Save the world. Buy Bitcoin.
That was easy.
I think that was like kind of the conclusion of our conversation. But,
yeah.
I mean, just on allocation and portfolio construction, I mean, as you may know, Brian serves as the CIO and CEO of Off the Chain Capital, and they recently just announced their financial performance. They made that public for the first time ever just the other week, and they are the number one performing fund out of all hedge funds.
Across all strategies.
Yeah, number one out of almost 6,000 hedge funds out
Congratulations,
there.
Congratulations, man.
That's over the last 5 years.
That's a really big
But the reason why, I mean, you see what a kind of a unique thinker Brian is, but the reason why is because he's applied this value approach to investing. So, I mean, it would be great if you maybe just broke that down a little bit.
Yeah, I would love to.
No one else is doing this, and it's so unique.
Yeah. So, I come from traditional finance, and I'm a value investor. And people say, well, how can you be a value investor in blockchain?
I know, right?
And so basically all we're doing is we're trying to buy $1 worth of blockchain assets for 50 cents. So we use a traditional Benjamin Graham, Warren Buffett value style, and find weird ways to buy Bitcoin at discounts. So we buy it through bankruptcy courts. We buy it through futures contracts on hash rates from Bitcoin miners. We find employees at blockchain companies who helped start these companies 5 years ago, but now they have a life event. They're getting married, getting divorced, having a baby, buying a house, and they need liquidity. They need to sell some of their company's equity to buy the house. And so we buy their equity from them at a discount to what we think it's worth. And so it's not complicated what we're doing. We're just no one else is doing it.
This is what hedge funds used to do.
Right.
And now they're all, I joke that like all the assets under management in the hedge fund space have effectively gone into the sort of, you know, the kind of the big four, if you think of it from a pot shop perspective, the Citadel, Millennium, Point 72, yeah. Ballyasny, all those kinds of firms where you have really smart guys, you know, Winklevoss, Harvard, Yale type mm-hmm. folks like myself. We get in a room, they give us a coloring book, they give us, you know, crayons, and they give us a picture of Santa Claus and tell us to color. Well, we're all going to color the shirt red and the boots black mm-hmm. and the beard white. And that's what we're all doing. And finance yeah. used to be like, let's go yeah. find some esoteric opportunities and get an actual return and mm-hmm. take some risk. Mm-hmm. And so I'm really proud to see that someone is out there doing that and really generating returns and obviously educating the community. So, Brian, we really appreciate you.
I appreciate that. Yeah, and then the last word I have is so everyone could buy Bitcoin, right? You can go to PayPal, you know, Schwab, Fidelity, whatever. If you buy Bitcoin, if you own Bitcoin, just do yourself a favor, because what happens is that Bitcoin is very volatile. It's going to go up a lot as you own it. When it goes up a lot, don't sell it. You'll have this urge to sell it because you just made a lot of money, but don't sell it. When it goes down 70%, don't sell it either, because you'll have this urge to sell it when it goes down. The best thing to do is just hold it. Hold it for the next 10 to 20 years, never sell it. And that's all you have to do. Don't overthink it. Don't think that I could out-trade Bitcoin. No one could out-trade Bitcoin. Just buy it and hold it for the next 10 to 20 years. That's all you have to do.
I'll add one thing to that too. If you understand where you are in the market and the economic and liquidity cycles, which is something we specialize in, I certainly specialize in, there are better times to buy it than other times.
Yeah, so we have models that help us value Bitcoin.
Exactly.
So our models say that Bitcoin's extremely undervalued today.
Yeah.
So Bitcoin's fair
on,
market.
On what duration?
Like, today.
Like, I mean, when you say undervalued, do you anticipate the sort of getting back to appropriate valuation over 3 weeks, 3 months, 3 years?
No one knows.
Gotcha.
Right?
Gotcha.
Yeah. So we know that if you use a stock to flow model or you use Metcalfe's law, or you use...
What's Metcalfe's law?
Metcalfe's law is how you value a network. Yeah. So you square the number of users, and then what we do is we multiply that times the transactional volume going through the Bitcoin network, and you come up with a number. And that number says Bitcoin's fair market value today is around 50,000.
Oh, wow.
And it's trading for like 38,000. Gotcha. Okay. If we use the stock-to-flow model, which is how you value commodities like gold, that model says that Bitcoin's worth $100,000 today. And so it's undervalued. But these models tell us that in the future, Bitcoin's going to be worth like $1 million in 2025 and $10 million in 2029. Mm-hmm. And these models are between 94 and 99% correlated to the historical price of Bitcoin over the last 13 years. So they're very accurate models.
In sample or out of sample? That makes a huge difference.
What do you mean, in sample or out of
sample? Is that correlation, is the model been trained on that data?
It's using that data.
So it's in sample. Yeah, mm-hmm. Gotcha. I'd love to see that out of sample because that'd be a different. But still, that's really high.
Yeah, it's very high. Yeah,
it's
extremely
high.
If you go to
regardless.
A casino and there's a 95% chance that you're going to be, the model works and you're betting that all day long.
Gotcha. So. Well, this is excellent, man. I appreciate you guys stopping by and joining us. I'm not as good as Pomp at being Pomp, but I'm pretty good.
I think you did a great job.
Yeah, thank you. Hope everything's all well.
A lot better looking than Pomp.
I don't think Polina thinks that, but you know, it is what it is. Well, appreciate you, Perry Ann Boring, Brian Estes. I'm Darius Dell. We'll catch you back here next time. Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to today's episode. I really hope you guys enjoyed this one. Make sure you're subscribed on Apple, Spotify, or your favorite podcast player. And if you're looking to try to transition to get a new job in the Bitcoin or crypto industry, we've got you covered. Head over to pompscryptocourse.com. We've developed a curriculum with the top teams across the industry. It's a 3-week intensive training program with over 50 events packed into that 3-week time period. Go to pompscryptocourse.com to learn more, and I'll meet you guys for the next episode.